an FTA negotiation goes through quite a lengthy process. I'm going to talk about a generic FTA rather than TPP specifically, but I'm sure there will be elements that I discuss which you'll want to relate in some way to TPP. But to start with, an FTA really has two components to it. So the first component is the legal text. And that component is where we enshrine the rules that are going to apply to that free trade agreement and to trade under that particular agreement. The second component are the commitments that we make to each other on market access provisions. And they are contained in what we call schedules, which are attached to the legal text in particular chapters. So the process that we go through to negotiate is we invariably start with the legal text. And the reason we do that is that is what sets the framework for then considering the commitments that we're going to make on market access. You don't want to put down a request or an offer on market access until you have some sense of the rules that are going to apply. So that's the approach that we take. Now, for this negotiation, we're still at the text stage. We haven't yet got to the stage of putting on the table schedules and therefore starting negotiations on market access specifically. But we are talking about market access in the sense that we are talking about the rules that will apply to it in due course. Okay, everyone with me so far? Right. Well, let me talk a little bit about how we go about negotiating text, because we're at that stage with TPP, it's the bit that I think is quite difficult to explain, but it's and it changes from negotiation to negotiation. But essentially, what normally happens is that in the initial round or two of any FTA, we will spend time talking to the other party about our existing FTA practices in terms of what are the issues that we want to cover in the text, what has been our approach in previous FTAs. We do a lot of information exchange to try and get a sense of how the other party approaches it and what might be the issues that we might confront. Then from that point, we then start generating specific proposals. In some cases, we might exchange fully fledged texts with each other. In other cases, and particularly in the case of plurilateral negotiations where you have a lot of participants, we may actually, instead of giving each other a draft chapter, we might instead provide each other text elements. So it will be draft text on the bits that we particularly are concerned about. Then what happens is when we've got all of that, we put it all together and we start looking at what are the common elements, how do these texts actually address the issues that we want to address, are they going to deliver the right outcomes, are they going to create problems for our domestic policy settings, and so on. So the process of actually negotiating on that text is really to progressively form a view on whether or not we are seeking similar outcomes, in which case it's just a question of what language we use that for, or do we have genuine issues. As we reach commonality on particular texts, we remove brackets so that we've got agreed text. At the moment for this negotiation, we've got thousands of brackets because we've only really at the point where we've got all the text elements on the table. So that's the process of text. You usually, in a negotiation, get to a certain point, and we're not there yet for TPP, but you get to a certain point where you're starting to build up a pretty good idea of what the rules framework is going to look like. And at that stage, you then start the next stage of the negotiation, which is to negotiate on market access commitments. And that process starts with sometimes a discussion about whether or not we're going to apply a certain methodology or whether we're simply going to put proposals on the table for each other's market access. There's many different methodologies that can be used on market access for goods. There's a key issue for services and investment, which is whether or not you schedule what we call a positive list or a negative list. The positive list says these are the rules in the text that we're going to apply to trade and services between us, and the positive list sets out the range of services to which those rules apply. So nothing else is covered. A negative list is the reverse. It says these are all the rules that we're going to apply, except for these particular sectors that are enshrined in the negative list. We like negative lists because they're much more certain. People know what is out of the FTA, and therefore everything else is covered. So they have an enduring future-proofing to negative lists, whereas with positive lists, you have to keep adding. You have to have a negotiation all the time about adding new sectors to the positive list. We have not yet reached the point of starting negotiations on the market access at this stage. That will be for a later round. We're still at the tech stage of it. So that'll give you a sense of framework. Then, of course, once you've gone for a certain period of market access, you reach the point where you are down to the core issues. And those core issues will be, there'll be a few rules issues that you haven't managed to resolve. There will be elements in the market access schedules that you haven't been able to resolve, and they become a package of issues which form the hardcore negotiation at the end of an FTA negotiation. The other point that I would make about all of this is that a negotiation is about building up a good package. So we typically look to set aside the more difficult issues. We might, in the initial stages, we might deal with them in various ways. We might decide that, yes, we can see that we have two different approaches here, they're going to present real difficulties, and we might decide, let's wait till further in the negotiation when the rest of it is clearer, how we're then going to handle those. So we'll set them to one side completely. Or it may be that you have issues where, frankly, we just don't understand how the other side, how that text relates to how the other side approaches the enforcement, for example. In those cases, we might actually spend a number of rounds talking about, well, how do you do this, with a lot of information exchange. But eventually, of course, you will reach a point where you actually have to address those. Then there's a third reason we might not deal with them. Sometimes it's just tactically not a good idea to talk about some of those issues in the early stages when you're trying to build up trust and confidence between the negotiating teams, especially if you know it's going to be one of those issues that ultimately has to be dealt with by ministers, you know, at a political level, in which case sometimes you deliberately leave it to quite late in the negotiation to start reflecting on it. Unless, of course, it's so central to the negotiation, you have to deal with it earlier on. So that's kind of the generic approach. That structure is common to all FTAs, but there are a lot of variations in how you'll go about it, where the difficulties will lie. Methodology issues can take a year to negotiate. With this negotiation, because we're building from an existing FTA, a lot of those have already been resolved in the existing FTA structure. So any questions?
Yeah, you said that you are still at the stage of legal text speaking, but framework of the market access,
yeah,
in terms of legal text, this has been discussed, you said that. But you don't understand that. What is the legal text framework of the market access?
Well, the legal text will deal with issues, for example, it will deal with major principles. It'll deal with how can I put this? It deals with the core principles that will apply to market access. So you know, it will state, for example, that, you know, what the objective of the market access provisions are, which is to remove tariffs. It will set any provisions that you need to think about in terms of temporary entry of goods. For example, if we are trading goods while we're removing tariffs during that transition period, there may be trade shows and the like where you are temporarily entering goods into another party. It will set the rules around those, what tariff is applied, etc. So there will be a whole lot of rules that actually apply to the market access, which then governs the schedules that you put in, which are about the elimination of tariffs and how they phase out. So they may also, the rules, it differs from FTA to FTA. The legal framework may also include guidance on how you read the schedules that are then attached. It may provide rules around the transition to the removal of tariffs, or some of those may be in the schedule themselves. As I say, it differs. People have different practices. But there will be some principles that are included in it. What are your objectives? What are you trying to do? And if you have in FTAs that might only, you know, might have some products that are not covered by the FTA, it may explain what you're going to do with those products. So there's a lot to be discussed, but that's the point at which they're discussing at the moment. They're talking about the actual legal framework under which those commitments sit. With goods as well, there's a whole host of chapters in an FTA that apply to goods. So you have the first one is market access. And then you also have rules of origin. And rules of origin, which has its own schedule, that sets out what goods qualify for coverage under the FTA. So it's whether or not a particular product, the product might be encapsulated in the schedule, but it may actually, the product coming from New Zealand, say, into the United States, may in fact be from a third country. It might just be transiting through New Zealand. So the rules of origin explain how third-party content in goods is handled effectively. And that has its own schedule attached to it to explain the rules product by product by product. It's a very complex and very boring area of work. Third area is customs and trade facilitation. And this is about how the actual processes at the border, so when goods come in, how you determine that it is the origin of a particular country, you know, what are the customs procedures that apply? If you've got a tariff classification question, can you get a ruling? It's all of those kinds of questions. Customs, and my observation as an FTA negotiator for New Zealand is that when we're negotiating with fellow Asian countries or when we're negotiating with anyone from APEC, that's not a difficult chapter to do. There's been a lot of work done in APEC. We've got and the customs agencies will know each other very well. And so this is very often a very early chapter to conclude. So you know, we have a lot of very similar practices. What else have I left out? There's technical barriers to trade. Which is also known as the TBT chapter. That's the jargon we all use. This is about behind the border measures such as certification practices, standards, labelling, country of origin labelling, food standard labelling, all of those kinds of things will be captured under the technical barriers to trade. And that typically sets out the framework which we agree for how we're going to manage those areas. Another one is sanitary and phytosanitary measures. Or SBS. This is a big one for agricultural exporting countries because this chapter, from a New Zealand perspective, what we want to do is build up a good working relationship with our fellow agencies in other countries to ensure that we are approaching this both from a food safety perspective and also from a trade facilitating perspective. So if we've got confidence in each other's systems, that we're not unrealistically holding up product to the border, that you know, we are seeing it flow. I'm sure I've missed out on obvious trade remedies. Trade remedies deal with they're supposed to deal with what I would describe as predatory trade practices. For example, if goods are flooding into the other market and disrupting the other market because you're subsidising those products, it's known as countervailing. If goods are being traded at below the cost of manufacture effectively in one market, they're flooding into the other country. So you're predatory pricing in the other country in order to grab market share and disrupt your competitors in that country. That's known as anti-dumping. So there's several sets of rules under that. It's an area which is always hotly debated in the FTAs. The WTO has provisions within the WTO agreements. There are provisions around that. Practice in this region is typically to default to the WTO agreements as the guiding framework for our FTAs. So all of those rules cover goods. And so we typically want to have a sense of how all of these chapters are shaping up when we start to negotiate market access to goods. The actual schedule for market access is attached to this chapter here. So that's the schedule of commitments. And that can be, it can be very simple. It might say we're going to remove all tariffs on entry into force. Or it might say we're going to remove all tariffs by year 10, and this is how we're going to handle the transition product by product by product. There's various ways you can construct a schedule negotiation. And then rules of origin also has a schedule attached. And what that tells you is the rule that will apply product by product by product to deal with third party content. We've got a country who is not a participant in the FTA. Where there is content in a particular good from a party who's not a participant, how that will be handled. Will it be counted as product from an FTA member or not? Many, many products now, because of global supply chains, many products have third party content in them. So there's always quite a negotiation around the rules to establish category by category what is a fair rule. And we in New Zealand prefer to have something that is quite transparent and liberal, so people know right from the start what the rules are. They're not having to engage in the user again. So that's the goods chapters.
Can I ask questions?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you talk about market access schedule,
yeah,
in a scalable legal text, that's quite essential to the negotiations. Like, for example, if you have already categorize the product.
Yeah.
This category has to be eliminated by 10 years, 11 years, whatever. It's almost a commitment, isn't it?
Yeah, but we do that. Well, sometimes we do it before we enter into negotiations. Mm. We might have had a negotiation that says, okay, let's agree that we're going to eliminate all tariffs within a 10-year time frame. It's going to be comprehensive.
Mm.
That is, in fact, what the P4 countries plus the United States said they were going to do when they started TPP.
Oh.
They were going to eliminate all tariffs within 10 years. So sometimes it's an upfront negotiation before you enter into it. Other times it's the result of the negotiation. You might start out thinking, okay, we both are pretty comprehensive, but one actually wants to exclude some products, and then you'll have a negotiation over whether or not they will exclude it or not exclude it, or whether they'll make some provision for access or not. And that might not just be about what's happening in other areas of market access, it may also involve negotiations on what's happening elsewhere in the FTA. You're always looking to find a balance within the FTA for your particular country.
So in case of TPP this around, you have already started talking about the kind of sensitive, but dairy products should be included, or sugar should be excluded, this kind of broader pictures. You know, where you start talking about these kind of issues?
I can't comment other than to note that at the beginning of it, when we announced TPP, this current generation of TPP, parties, when they announced it, said they were going to eliminate tariffs within 10 years.
On everything?
Sorry?
On all goods.
On all goods, yeah.
I'm quite interested in the negotiation and sort of the relationship between the TPP and CER, because I know that Mark's been talking a lot about CER in terms of examples.
Yes.
But the thing is, when you bring in Australia, essentially you've got a thing called the essentially the idea that if you give it to one country, you've got to give it to all. The sort of it works like a ratchet. That's the words I was looking for. So I guess that I was interested to know how New Zealand would get around that issue, because obviously the arrangements with Australia are probably going to be a lot more liberalised even after the TPP than they would be otherwise.
But Australia is an interesting case. CER is a free trade agreement, but it's 25 years old. And it's probably the most extensive now free trade agreement in the world because of its reach. It has components in it of what we call a customs union, which is what the European Union has, in that we've progressively added to CER aspects which are about regional integration. We exclude CER, so the provisions of CER, from all our trade agreements. So all of our successive trade agreements are built on the merits of that particular relationship, so anything in CER doesn't apply. So that's the way that we handle it. We're not obliged to give anyone anything that we've negotiated in CER.
Well, isn't there something like the most favoured nation clause that goes into sort of the WTO level, which could conceivably overrule that at some point?
Well, I would say the WTO has provisions within it, both in its goods in the GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, and in the General Agreement on Trade and Services, that there is a provision in both cases that excludes FTAs, providing they meet certain criteria, and our FTAs will meet those criteria. So if we have a most favoured nation provision in the GATTs, in terms of our commitments there, we're not obliged to give our GATS partners what we might negotiate in an FTA. We utilise that particular provision. So FTAs don't override the GATS in that respect, except in relation to that particular country that we've negotiated the FTA with.
But you go like the other way, where the WTO presents, or a country could take action, sort of say, under the WTO, sort of saying, well, look, you offer it to this country, therefore you should take it. You should offer it to all.
Well, I mean, there has been a... You're getting into very esoteric territory, I'll tell you. I mean, there are some shocking FTAs out there. I mean, ones that are essentially about preferential trade agreements, which don't... You know, what the WTO says, the rules say, is that you must cover substantially all the trade between the parties, and trade liberalisation, you know, the elimination of tariffs and barriers, must be the goal. But you have a lot of FTAs out there which don't even purport to do that. They're just essentially about providing some preferential trade access to another party. Some of those are justified under a thing we call the enabling clause within the GATT, which is a provision that allows a certain amount of regional integration between developing countries. So a lot of developing country FTAs, which we would not regard as free trade agreements, are justified under that. So, you know, there's various ways in which the WTO and FTAs can live together. But the point that I would make about all FTAs is that they are about progressively liberalising a market, whether it's to an individual party, a group of other countries, or on a multilateral level. And because we are a small country, or a small economy, we prefer the WTO because it sets the legal framework internationally. So we like to make sure that our FTAs are consistent with the WTO practices. But they do go further. than the WTO in many areas, typically in the area of market access.
We've spoken with Diego.
Hi, Nigel.
Next.
Yeah.
When do you relate to commitment, usually?
Yeah. It differs from negotiation to negotiation. I mean, a plurilateral negotiation, it can take a number of rounds before you actually feel you've got enough understanding or common understanding that you want to move to the next phase, which is market access. And FTAs typically move at the pace of the slowest partner in them. If someone's not ready to negotiate on a particular provision, there'll be no negotiation on that particular provision. Can't force someone to negotiate. So we tend to proceed at the pace of the slowest party. So with TPP, we're not quite at the stage of market access negotiations at this stage.
Can we expect early next year? The text is going to be finished?
You'd have to ask Mark. But the text may not be finished until the very end of the negotiation. Because there may be issues in the text which are difficult to resolve. So it differs from FTA to FTA. So a text may not be completed right till the very end. Yep. Any other questions?
I've got one more trivial one.
Yeah.
I guess at the moment, sort of your main distinction between talking about text at the moment,
yeah,
you're talking about the sort of the details of these terms of labour and schedules. Would this be the time that you'd be discussing things along the lines of whether the labour clause, for example, is included in the main text, or is included as like a memorandum of understanding as it is under the existing
PC? Yeah. Well, New Zealand likes to have, we like to have our labour provisions in the FTA.
Yeah.
A lot of our partners don't.
Yeah.
So the way that we tended to deal with that is that we tended to focus on the substance and leave aside the form, because the important thing for us is to have some avenue to have those provisions. But the critical thing for us is that we are able to try and secure those. So if our partner isn't prepared to have them in the FTA, but is prepared to have something, then we will compromise on form in order to get substance. So that's the way that we handle it.
But I guess the issue comes with essentially the form determines how enforceable those clauses can be.
Yeah, although all of ours are enforceable.
Mm.
that's a completely different issue. There are many forms of investor state, and the one everyone hates is the NAFTA one, which is the one all of the legal, pretty much everything you read about NAFTA, read about investor state is about the NAFTA provisions. The provisions that we have in our China agreement, very different. They have a lot of safeguards built in. Yeah, there was a question here just before we... Yeah.
So, on commitment.
Yeah.
The difference between APEC and TPP.
Yeah.
TPP has commitment.
Yes.
Most of those horizontal issues has been talked in APEC.
Well, APEC is a non-binding.
Non-binding.
Yeah, it's non-binding. It's something where we've moved towards progressive regional integration through a political process as opposed to a legally binding process. Whereas a free trade agreement is legally binding on the parties. So there are people who debate whether a political will or a political commitment can be as strong as a legally binding commitment. It comes down to the will of parties when it's said and done. But APEC is non-binding, which is why APEC has been throwing around these ideas of a free trade agreement with the Asia Pacific. Do we go from this political commitment to a legally binding commitment is the issue. Does that make sense?